As you do.
Yes. So today is week three and the last one of this small series. Paradox of Happiness. I just want to remind everyone again that next week we don't have a session. That's the 11th of May. And we start again in 2 weeks, which is the 18th, with a new series called Can I Make Room for the Other? And it's based on an interesting book, an Australian book actually, by Anne Main or something. I don't know exactly how you pronounce her name. Called The World of I. Very important.
The World of I.
The World of I.
I. You know, me, myself,
I as in me.
Me, myself, and I. Okay.
Should make a fascinating topic, hopefully. Okay. So just to review from last week. Last week we talked about two things, physical well-being and intellectual well-being. So in physical well-being, we talked about the connection between mind and body, connected in so many ways, both ways. The mind affects the body affects the mind. Of course, from a Jewish perspective, it's not just the mind and the body, it's the soul and the body. The soul is cannot achieve its purpose. In other words, purpose and meaning comes from the soul, but it cannot achieve it unless it's expressed through the body. Therefore, they have to work in a partnership, as we explained last week, that idea from the Baal Shem Tov, about not fasting, taking care of your body, and so on. We had that interesting little part that he highlighted about stress. He said stress is never a problem. It's the recovery from stress that's a problem. And we discussed that. That's why you need to be stressed. It's okay. It's part of life. It's part of growth, actually. But you need to be able to recover every so often. They talk about different levels, short-term, mid-term, and long-term. So, and all that, you know, moving around, not sitting in one place, and so on and so forth. We also talked about intellectual well-being, the power of the mind, and from a Jewish perspective, of course, what could be greater? We talked about the real importance and the critical component of intellectual pursuit, and especially godly pursuit, Torah pursuit, which is so much part of the Jewish experience. And learning deeply has so many benefits. First of all, cultivating curiosity, the idea of learning from everyone, the idea of humility together with learning, being able to learn when you learn and are curious. You learn from every person, no matter what level of learning they have. Discussed also the idea of deep learning, which is something that's missing today because people don't tend not to stay on something for a long time. The idea of going into something, analyzing something, and so on. And then learning also, always learning from our mistakes, learning to fail, learning by exploring new ideas and not worrying about messing up or failing because it's all part of the growth experience, ultimately leading to happiness. Okay, so this, what we based this all on was a formula from Tal Ben Shachar where he talks about the spire model, right? Pursuing not happiness, but pursuing things that bring happiness, which is the spiritual well-being, physical well-being, intellectual well-being, which we've talked about till now. And today we're going to talk about relational well-being and emotional well-being. So let's talk about relational well-being. Now, some of the things we've talked about many times, but it just adds some important perspective. So he starts off this chapter on relational well-being by asking the question, what is the best predictor of happiness? Now, the book is very research-based. He's a researcher. I mean, well, he's a therapist, but he based himself on scientific research. And we know that in the late 1930s, there was Harvard embarked on this ongoing long-term study of happiness, which is still continuing today, to track happiness and to track what are the predictors of happiness and so on. So, of course, what do they find? That it's not material success or prestige or accolades and so on. But the research said that the number one predictor of happiness is relationships. Which is not surprising. I mean, we know that. Specifically, having socially supportive, intimate relationships. And it's what amplifies the good times and carries us through the difficult ones. And the research actually was interesting. According to this research, it didn't really matter who it was with, right? In other words, who the relationship was, as long as it was a proper relationship. So not for everyone it was their spouse, or not for everyone it was like a very romantic relationship, but it was a solid relationship, right? And that's what sort of was the one number one predictor of the concept of happiness. Interesting, they included in the study, what's the best predictor of health, right? Which, of course, health depends on many factors, including physical well-being, but they did discover, we've talked about this before, that close relationships are also the number one predictor of health and happiness. Mm. Both. It actually is good for us to be in relationships. I don't know if you remember, we once actually quoted a research study, not even about deep relationships, but about connecting with people. That they did the study that even people who walk in the street and just make conversation with people, like, or people in the lift or on the escalator or whatever, actually study that brings longevity, which is fascinating, right? Okay. Now, it's interesting that another study, this is interesting where Australia sits in this, another study about happiness in different countries, right? So, not surprisingly, the United States does not have the happiest people in the world, right? So despite that it's a very leading country in terms of affluence and wealth and so on, it's actually not a country of a lot of happy people. I mean, you can tell that by looking at the news, but it's also documented and researched. Nor does China, Japan, Singapore, South Korea, Germany, UK, even though all these countries are among the most materially successful and prosperous, right? Interesting. So in the study, they talked about countries like Colombia, Denmark, Norway, Costa Rica, Israel, and even Australia, which consistently rank among the highest of being a place of happy people. Fascinating. Even though these countries have had their fair share of challenges, right? I mean, Australia's a pretty calm country, but if you talk about Israel, that's the more surprising one, right? I mean, they just have challenge as we speak. And the reason they discovered was that in these countries, relationships is very, very important, right? There's a tremendous emphasis on social connection and social support, which is fascinating. For example, in Denmark, 93% of the Danes are active members of social clubs. So this is the basis of this discussion, right? That relationships, connection with other people are critical in achieving happiness. Now, we know that the famous phrase, no man is an island, no man is an island, in other words, loneliness cannot happen, a person cannot sit alone. The Rambam talks about this, that a person is a medini, a person is someone that needs to be with other people. Not a great discovery in terms of Jewish thinking. We know that right from the very, very beginning. We've mentioned this many times. That Adam and Eve, God said, "Lo tov heyote Adam levado." It's not good for the man to be alone. Or Rabbi Soloveitchik translated, not only to be alone, but to be lonely, right? And therefore, we understand that connection with other people is incredibly, incredibly important. Incidentally, when he wrote this book, they were in the middle of COVID lockdowns. Right, it's a couple of years old. So obviously it brings in the whole shift in dynamics of relationships during COVID, which for some, it was actually not so bad. Some actually deepened their relationships. For some, it was a big problem. Sitting in the same roof with someone you don't get on with was a big problem. But the concept that he talks about obviously is very much connected to all relationships, COVID or not COVID, right? Now, he talks about relationships mean a deep relationship, right? So relationship, deep doesn't mean romantic necessarily, but deep does mean deep. Deep means a connection with someone else, right? And then, of course, he says deep and meaningful and intimate relationships play a crucial role in our becoming anti-fragile, right? Remember, at the beginning of the book, he talks about anti-fragility. Or our ability to grow stronger from hardship. Interesting, he says, loneliness, as you might expect, erodes health and happiness. Among other things, it is associated with depression, heart disease, and a weaker immune system. Right? You know, it's interesting, just to pause there for a moment. Israel is one of the happiest countries, as we just said, and obviously community means a lot there. But I think generally in the Jewish world, I think one of the things the Jewish nation excels in is the concept of community, right? And it's quite extraordinary when you see it really in action. I want to share with you something that I read the other day. So I don't know if you know this, but in Montreal over Pesach, specifically in the area which is a very, very, very Jewish area, there was a terrible snowstorm, right? And what actually happened, I mean, imagine this happening Erev Pesach, right? The electricity got shut down for a few days, but it happened Erev Pesach. So people were left without food, without heat, and if you know anything about the Canadian winter, it's worse than New York, put it that way. So it's really terrible, and it became a crisis. It was actually a real crisis, right? I mean, during Chol HaMoed, after the Yom Tov, they were doing, I saw online, they were doing appeals to help people and amazing stuff, and people who had frozen up their 3 days of Yom Tov food, right? I mean, it's a huge expense, not like not. But there was a real problem. It was much more than just an expense of food. There was a real health crisis because there were people who were elderly, there were people who were not well, and they were actually in actual danger. I mean, health danger, right? So in New York, in heavily populated Jewish communities, put it that way, even in Melbourne they have this now, but New York and Muncie, I've seen it in action, it's unbelievable. They have these organizations, these chesed organizations, which are just unbelievable. One of them is called Chaverim, right? Because Jewish communities, particularly the more observant ones actually, become very community-based, they become very self-sufficient. Because often the resources and the services you get from the general society that you're in are not very efficient very often, right? Which is why Tzolos was started, right? Tzolos was a community thing that was started amazingly, I mean, by someone who saw someone pass away because the ambulance didn't come in time, right? It's amazing what one person could do. You know that. It was in Williamsburg many, many years ago, about 50, 60 years ago, when a guy outside of a shul, a Satna Chassid, I think, had a heart attack. They called the ambulance and the ambulance came too late. And he said, this can't happen. We've got to start a community, you know, sort of thing. And every country, it works differently. I mean, today, in some countries, it's just unbelievable. South Africa, it's amazing what they do. New York, all these places, right? But they also started this organization called Chaverim. Chaverim are an organization where mainly volunteer-based. So up until a simple thing, you drive in, you get a flat, or your battery dies, or something like that. You call Chaverim, they're there very, very soon, and they'll help you out. Anyway, so there was a real crisis in Montreal, so I read that Hatzalah and Chaverim partnered and they sprung into action on Yom Tov because there was no problem breaking Yom Tov for this because people were actually in danger. And they started sourcing generators and food and stuff, particularly for these families who were in crisis, right? And then they ran out of generators because it was just so many. How many generators can a city have, right? So instantaneously they connected with Chaverim in New York. And the guy's telling the story that he saw his phone ring, doesn't answer the phone on Shabbos or Yom Tov, but when he saw it ring a lot of times, being Chaverim, he knew obviously it's an emergency, picked up the phone, they talked to each other on Yom Tov, they sprang into action, there was huge trucks loaded with generators, like in a day, coming from Muncie. They made it happen in a way where it was like 2 hours closer than from New York, it was, I think, Muncie somewhere, it was closer than New York, and by the second day Yom Tov, all the generators were there. I mean, it's a lot of details I'm leaving out because I don't remember, but I just read this article a couple of weeks ago. Absolutely fascinating. And you see like that power of community, just astounding. I mean, we tend to be petty when things are going well and we fight with each other and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, it's family and it's community. And that's what community means. It's support, right? And that's really what he's talking about. I'm imagining, and that's why Israel is one of the happiest places, because there's this, I mean, in the Jewish world, it doesn't matter how religious a person is, but in the Jewish world, that sense of community is just very, very strong, right? I mean, they might fight like cats and dogs there, but they're family. At the end of the day, they're family, right? Talking about fighting like cats and dogs, I don't know if you saw this, you know, in Bnei Brak, this is really funny. In Bnei Brak, there was two very interesting things. So you know, right now, there's protests on both sides. There's the judicial reform. It's out of control. So the main anti-protests were in Tel Aviv, thousands of people. They're the ones who are very anti the government at the moment, and they were protesting. Then they decided the case. They decided I'm not sure why. I don't think they understand themselves why. It just became a thing. So they decided to blame the Haredim. So they decided to stage this huge protest in Bnei Brak, which is a very, very heavily, densely populated city of Haredim. So what do they do in Bnei Brak? They knew it was coming. So instead of fighting back, they put out these huge signs and stalls with water, coffee, cake, cholent, and they offered cholent and coffee and cake to the demonstrators. And they played music. And then there was this one viral video, it was amazing, about a guy who came to Tel Aviv, very, very unaffiliated. I mean, very Israeli, but very unaffiliated. Very, very secular. Hadn't kept, you know, and I don't know if you know, but in Israel, when you're secular, like they're secular, you know, they Israelis don't know how to do things half measure. So like, you know, if you're like you're religious, you're crazy if religious. If you're secular, you're crazy secular, right? That's how it works. That's a problem with Israel because they never meet in the middle, these people. So there's one guy, an older guy. He was there by the demonstration, and he hears on the, because I think it was like a Thursday night or something, he hears on the loudspeaker Shalom Aleichem being played. You know, Franah, Shalom Aleichem. And he stops because he hadn't heard Shalom Aleichem for years since he was a child in his father's house. And he started to cry. So coming there to demonstrate and you know, it was beautiful. And then just the other day, they staged a demonstration near the Knesset, also some religious MK, on his policies and like that. So on his way to Knesset, he came out with coffees and cakes. So we're a family. We disagree. We fight with each other, but it's family. And that's the power of community. It's amazing. Anyway. So, not surprisingly, we always say this, but obviously you can't leave this out when you're having this discussion, when you're talking about deep relationships. Relationships are becoming more and more shallow since the introduction of social media, and there's no. He cites a research from Gene Twenge, her name is. She's a professor in San Diego State University. It's going to come up in the research in the next series, actually. She's an unbelievable researcher in this area, and she said that between 2012 and 2017. So that's not only COVID, right? Levels of loneliness went up to close 30% among teenagers. Depression went up by more than 30%. Suicide rates went up by over 30%. It's staggering. I mean, this is like epidemic stuff, right? And the main culprit to blame is social media.
Yeah.
First of all, people, it's on two levels. It's like a double-edged thing, right? Because they are spending so much time on social media and not interacting with actual human beings. And the second thing is they're learning different models of social interaction, which is incredibly shallow, incredibly superficial. And then so he just says there's no, people ask him advice and how do you, there's no advice. It's just very simple. People have to just get off social media, or at least chunks of the day, stop doing that and actually have downtime and actually have technology free hours and blocks and things like that where people can actually connect, right? And he says it's not just about interaction, physical interaction, it's how we interact. So he says what we need to do now is instead of thinking, again, this was written in COVID, so, right? He says, instead of thinking virtual versus physical, we have to think superficial versus deep. Which means even if we do interact with people now, because we've become so much less deep and more superficial, we need to actually think about what does it mean to connect deeply. And connecting deeply doesn't have to be with a lot of people, but it has to be some people in our life where we have deep relationships with and deep connections in order to achieve the concept of what we're talking about and bringing happiness. Now, connected to this, of course, is the idea of empathy. What's also dramatically gone down, as we've mentioned before, there are different studies. One is by a psychologist called Sarah Kornrath, who has discovered that in many, many countries, levels of empathy have gone down, right? Now, he makes two important points for this. He says, first of all, what is empathy? Empathy means being able to understand and identify with what others are feeling. Is it right? It's like a moral thing, that, right? Empathy is what ties us together, and when our ability to empathize decreases, it spells trouble for us as a society. So it's not just about not having empathy, it's actually a real problem, right? Now, of course, because people are less authentic today, people are not interacting with each other, people don't notice each other, and therefore, obviously, that's what's lessening the levels of empathy. And then he says a very interesting point, and I think this is a good point for lots of things. As I said, he's like a really good writer, right? And he brings out points really, really clearly. I'm going to read it to you. He says like this. Given the declining levels of empathy, calls abound. Everyone's calling now for what? For empathy education, classes in schools. Now he says, while that would be a step in the right direction, alone it's not enough. Right? And that's a real, everyone always calls for, let's call for classes, right? First of all, it's always the school's fault. So school will fix it, right? So let's should bring in empathy classes. I mean, the same thing with drug education, alcohol stuff. It's always
bullying,
everything. Let's bring in classes. And he says it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Where he says, let's say I want to learn to speak Vietnamese. So I enroll in classes. While my Vietnamese will certainly improve, it'll improve much more if I go to Vietnam and immerse myself in the culture that speaks the language. Very simple, right? The same is true for the language of empathy. We can learn about the importance of putting ourselves in other people's shoes by reading and taking a class. I might read, and he quotes, a study on the theory of moral sentiments by Adam Smith. I guess he talks about empathy. Or take a class on an ethical construct. But the more effective method is to immerse ourselves in a place where empathy is spoken. That is to go wherever I can interface to face with other people. In other words, deep relationships bring empathy, right? You can't learn empathy from a class. It's a beautiful point, right? It's the same thing, by the way, with any value. Values have to be lived. Again, you know, they always, as I say, they always bring in classes, they bring in speakers and motivational speakers to schools, talk about, you know, the effect of drugs and the consequences and all that. First of all, it's too late in high school, second, number one. And second of all, it's a good thing to do as a supplement, but it's not going to fix the problem. People have to grow up at home in a culture of self-control, of self-discipline, of values, of right from a very, very young age. You have to be immersed in that culture for it to make a difference. Okay. Now, the other thing that brings happiness in terms of relationships, he talks about the power of giving. Okay. Now, there's a fascinating piece of the Talmud, which he doesn't bring, but I'll share it with you. And it's about the relationship between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. You asked me before about Lag BaOmer, so here you have it. So next week is Lag BaOmer. Both Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, just parenthetically, are the two sages that are very much spoken about around this time of the year. We know that the reason that we partially mourn around the time of the Omer and don't have weddings and things like that is because Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest sages that ever lived, and he had 24,000 students that all died around this time of the year because of lack of respect for each other, actually. And God was particularly harsh with them, being on the level that they were, so he brought about an epidemic which killed them. And he was left with a number of students, but Rabbi Akiva, rather than give up, was in his amazing, amazing way. His resilience was incredible. I mean, can you imagine losing a whole generation of scholars? He had five left, and he rebuilt Torah learning and Torah knowledge. Thanks to him, we have still Jewish knowledge today, of the oral Torah, Talmudic knowledge, and he rebuilt it. And he had a particular close relationship with his student, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, Rabbi Akiva, as we know, lived in an incredibly... also, Lag BaOmer, sorry, is also the yahrzeit, the day of passing of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great Kabbalist. He was a Kabbalist, he wrote the Zohar and so on. Now, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai had a very, very close relationship. But Rabbi Akiva also lived in a time of tremendous suppression, under Roman rule, where for a certain period of time, in a very brutal and aggressive way, they prohibited Torah study. Right? And they incarcerated him. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai went to visit him. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said to Rabbi Akiva, his teacher, he said, "Lamdeini Torah." He said, "Teach me Torah." So he said, "I'm not going to teach you because it's right now it's incredibly dangerous." So it was more about putting Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in danger, actually. So he said, he kind of said, "But you're not the one that's in danger. You're already in jail. I'm the one. Don't worry. Like, I want to learn Torah, right?" Anyway, there's a bit of back and forth. But at the end, he said like this. Amar lo, Rabbi Akiva said to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, "Bini, my son, yoter mimasha ha'egel rotze linak, para rotze lehanik. More than the calf wants to nurse, the cow wants to feed." Right? In other words, you think it's just you that wants to receive. I need to give more than you need to receive. And this is a concept which is very much in line with what he talks about over here. He says the power of giving. And again, you know, it's amazing what they could do today, research-wise, in terms of like clarifying these things more scientifically. So there was a study the first part of the study was that researchers brought in a group of people and measured their levels of happiness. You know, you can do that. You can, like, it's brainwave and endorphins, whatever you call these things, right? You know, the biology side of things is not my area, but. So anyway, they measured the levels of happiness. Then they gave them each a nice sum of money and told them to spend it on themselves. Okay. So the subjects went on a shopping spree. And then the researchers measured the levels of happiness again. Now what happened was, as a result of their shopping spree, right after it actually went up. Happiness went up dramatically, right? But then they brought them to the lab a day later. And after 24 hours, it went right back to where it was, where they started off. Proving, obviously, what we always talk about, pleasure doesn't bring happiness. It brings a good feeling temporarily, doesn't bring happiness. Then the second part, they brought a different group of people, randomly selected, and measured their levels of happiness. Then they gave them the same amount of money and told them to go out and spend it, only this time the participants had to spend it on someone else. Right? They came back to the lab and again had the happiness assessed. Now, it went up the same amount that the other group did, but when the next day the researchers measured the levels of happiness again, and it went down a little bit, but it was still significantly higher than where they started from. It's a pretty cool study, actually. So the point is, and this is of course very, very much spoken about in Talmudic literature, that when you give, you get. Yeah. Right? When you give, you receive. I mean, apart from what the Talmud says, that giving tzedakah, giving charity is a blessing for getting it back even more fold, but it doesn't mean you always get money back. And giving doesn't always mean you give money. Giving can be many, many, many things, right? Anne Frank wrote in her diary, you can always give something, even if it's only kindness. Mm-hmm. Right? Depends, and we all have what to give. Although, of course, tzedakah charity is obviously part of giving. So, normally I supplement what I'm sharing you from this book with Torah perspective, but he does it himself this time, which is quite amazing. Because he must have remembered this from his youth, because his mother tongue is Hebrew. So, let me just show if I didn't put it in the handout, I should have. But, sorry. Right, so what's the word to give in Hebrew? Natan, right? Now, I put a regular nun, yeah, I should put a final nun, but it's the same letter, I just want you to understand. It's one of these words that Natan, you give, but it also goes exactly back the same way. Right? Actually, it's even better because where this actually comes from, I mean, he says it with Natan that way, but actually where it comes from is where, it's a longer word, where in the Mishkan, when they built the Mishkan in the desert, God told Moses for people to donate to the Mishkan, and it says v'natnu, so it's a longer word, and they shall give. And if they're exactly the same thing, v'natnu is read both ways exactly the same. V'natnu from right to left, from left to right, both ways v'natnu. Because it's a cycle thing, because giving is really receiving, right? Which is an amazing thing. I mean, it's an amazing thought to understand that when we give, we're not doing anyone else a favor, we're doing ourselves a favor, right? It's good for us to give. To give is good for us. But it's also a part of happiness. So true happiness, inner happiness, the real part of happiness only comes from giving. So empathy, relationships, and part of relationships is building empathy. Part of relationships is giving away from ourselves. He then goes on, and I want to just pause. I want to dwell on this a bit, and I want to share with you an idea. He then goes on to talk about that giving, of course, a person can't only give, because if you just give, you're left with someone who can't give anymore, right? So yes, it's true. One has to give to themselves as well, and then one has to take care of oneself, give to oneself, and so on and so forth. Which, as you know, it's one of my pet subjects. It's becoming a very, very big topic nowadays. Everyone is into self-care and self-preservation and boundaries and all this kind of stuff. So I want to share with you an idea with this, because where is the balance, right? It's obviously true. I mean, from a Jewish perspective, the ideal is selflessness. But it's obviously true that in order to be selfless, there has to be someone there to be selfless, right? So obviously we have to take care of ourselves, and we do have to give to ourselves. So when is it egocentric? When is it selfish? And when is it legitimate self-care, right? So I want to share with you an idea that actually... it relates to another thing, because I mean, although he does say it, and it's just a small paragraph in the book about taking care of ourselves, which is true and legitimate, taking care of our health, taking care of ourselves, giving to ourselves sometimes, so on, so we should be healthy and on all levels, psychologically, emotionally, and so on. That's 100% true. But I think that today it's gone too far. Everyone is really into self care. So I want to share with you an idea that I. Recently, I came up with this concept based on an interpretation of a passage in Pirkei Avot. So it's in your handout. You see it? Okay. So actually, in that particular passage in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, it talks about four types of people. We're going to focus on two. So it says like this: one who says, Because it talks about like this. You know, go from the bottom up. One who says what is mine is yours and what is yours is a chassid, which means over there a pious person. It means, yeah. It's part. No, no. It's a part of the Mishnah. So, right. So it's based on the Torah, of course. I mean, it's part of the oral Torah, right? So it's like the Talmud, just like the Talmud is part of the oral Torah. So it's everything is based on the Torah, was the Chumash, right? But then things were handed down from sage to sage, from generation to generation. Things were interpreted, and then it was learned all orally, but then recorded. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, which lived around the second or third century. He was one to codify the Mishnah. He took all the teachings that was there from the sages and throughout the generations and recorded them. Now, for the most part, the Mishnah and the Talmud, which is the interpretation of the Mishnah, for the most part, it's legalistic, right? The Talmud is not just... I mean, the Talmud is a conglomeration of everything, ethics, and midrashic, everything. But the Mishnah is most legalistic, but there is one part of the Mishnah, which is all the teachings, moral teachings, like ethical teachings, relationship teachings, and that's Pirkei Avot. Right, I think once is the written Torah.
Right.
So these are sages, like Rabbi Akiva taught this, and Hillel taught that, and anonymous sages taught the following, and they put together all the inspiring words, which are all based on the Torah and written in holiness and in purity and by very, very wise and great people. But it's the oral Torah, known as Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, this particular section of the Mishnah, right?
Where did the 613 come from?
That comes from the Torah itself, but sometimes very briefly. We need the oral Torah to explain it, right? I'm just smiling because what I should do really, because I feel interested, I should give a separate share of this. It's actually be a fascinating thing to understand how it all works, actually.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I'll put it on the agenda. Okay.
Okay, sorry.
Just to understand how it all works, oral Torah, written Torah, development of halakha, how does it work? Like,
yes.
What's from the rabbis, what's from the Torah? Yeah, it'll be a fascinating thing. So I'll do that. Please God. Blin er, as I say. Okay. So there are four groups of people, it says. So let's just go from the bottom. It says, one who says, what is mine is yours, and what is yours, that's a pious person, right? You see, that's a completely selfish person, doesn't need anything for themselves, he's ready to give away, doesn't want anything from you, but what mine is yours, that's a pious person. I'd imagine most of us are not at that level, at least in the extreme, but it's a mindset, it's something to understand. Okay. Look at the second one, it says, before it says, if a person says, what is mine is mine, and what is yours, that is a median characteristic, which means that's like average, that's normal, right? Now the Hebrew, I should have put Hebrew here, because the Hebrew says, yesh omrim, some people say, right? This is actually not a median characteristic, it's the character of a sodomite.
I don't agree.
Sodomite, right?
Yeah.
That's quite harsh. You know, Sodom were like the most selfish people, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sodom the war,
So it always bothered me, this, like, first of all, why is it a characteristic of a sodomite? Number one. And number two, when you have a dispute in a Mishnah, I mean, the Talmud and the Mishnah are full of disputes, right? That's where we learn. This one says this, this one says this, this one says this interpretation, that interpretation. But it's gotta be in a similar context. Like when two people argue, you know what I'm saying? Like, for example, if we had an argument about the color of the wall, right? So I would say, you know, it's white. You say, no, you're colorblind. It's actually not white. It's cream. Yeah, you're right. Okay, that makes sense, right? Or if you say it's beige, or if you say, no, you really need your eyes checked because actually it's more like, more, you know. But if if I said this wall is white and you said the wall is purple, I mean, that's like ridiculous. I mean, right? It's, okay. So how do you get from being normal to being a sodomite? Like, how are they looking at the same thing? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How they look at exactly the same behavior, and the one saying is that it's average. It's not pious, but it's average, normal behavior, right? And the other one says no, it's a sodomite. It's like terrible behavior, right?
Isn't your perception your reality?
No, but what is it? In other words, but it's the same. If a person says, "Look, I'm not," I mean, for example, there's another one in the Mishnah of the four people where someone says. Someone says, "What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine." I mean, that's an evil person. Okay, that we understand, right?
Yeah.
Or the other one that says, the person says, "What's mine is yours, and what's yours is mine."
Correct.
She says, "That's a silly person." I mean, the world doesn't work like that, right? In other words, I can say what's mine is yours, but I can't decide that you have to be pious also. That's not my business, right? You know, you can, like they say in Yiddish, "Avyenim scheshbin." You know, so, like on the other person's shoulders, you can't do that. can't say, look, I'm going to be pious, but you're going to be pious back. No, you can't do that. You want to be pious, right? Okay. But over here, this is normal behavior. What's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. Kind of good. That, you know, I won't steal from you, you won't steal from me. I won't take from you, you won't take from me. Normal behavior. And one says, no, it's sodomite behavior. So I once heard a vort as a kid, and I want to apply it to this concept. And I think that's a very good formula, right? First of all, it's interesting, the Mishnah also quotes the one of the pious. Now, as I said, a pious person means a completely selfless person. What's mine is yours, what's yours is yours. Can a person be always like that? It's very difficult. Maybe the famous Rav Zusha of Anipoli, I told you that story about him, that he didn't need anything and nothing ever happened to him. Most people are not like that. Most people are not at the level where they can always say, whatever's mine is yours, you know. It's a hard thing, right? They tell the great people like that. You know, I'll give you an example of Chaim Briska, a famous rabbi in the Briska town. He was a great Rosh Hashiva, a great Rav. Actually, the grandfather of Soloveitchik. Very famous, great sage. He was known in his house, like the selflessness was unbelievable. People used to come and just make themselves comfortable, stay the night. They say him and his wife, I never actually knew who was staying there, never knew. People were there, completely selfless. Like it was Grand Central Station and he didn't mind. Okay. Not everyone can reach that. So why does the Mishnah talk about it? Because often we read about extreme piety, not because the Mishnah expects us to be that way, but expects us to understand it as such a concept that may be implemented from time to time, to like an aspirational thing, you know, to move 1 centimeter closer to that concept of becoming a better person. So it gives us selflessness in its extreme to teach us, you know, don't only say what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, but from once in a while, move a little bit closer to the pious. Okay, fine. So what's the normal behavior? The normal behavior is what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, right? So here's a different way to read the Mishnah. It works better in the Hebrew, actually, the Mishnah. But anyway, let me explain to you. Mishnah like this. If one lives their way, if one says, look, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. In other words, I'm not completely selfless. I'm not Rav Chaim Briska. You know, I'm not Rav Zusha. It's normal behavior. But the Yesh Omrims, it's not actually a dispute. It's not a dispute. It's actually two parts of the same thing. But the Yesh Omrim, which means some say. What does it mean, some say? Which means if it becomes a philosophy, becomes a way of life, it becomes a shita, an opinion. If it becomes your whole philosophy of life, that what's mine is mine, is yours is yours, that's a sodomite. That's the difference. If, in theory, I would aspire to a selfless way of living, but I know I need to take care of myself, obviously, you know, and also I'm not at the level where you just walk into my house and take whatever you want, and I won't know who's sleeping there at night. I'm not there yet, but you know, but I understand that's something to look up to. That's normal, you're a normal guy. That's good. But v'yesh omrim, but if you make a whole philosophy out of boundaries, out of self-care, out of what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, and don't intrude and don't interfere and don't this and don't that, that's a sodomite. And I think that's what's happening nowadays. That's what's such a thing, right? Yeah. Of course we have to give to ourselves, and he's correct. And particularly in this book, he's correct because he puts it just as a one paragraph in the context of everything else. That giving sometimes means giving to yourself, and of course we should. And when we need to step down, when we need to, you know, to be unavailable, when we need to take care of ourselves so that we can give, that's normal. Some people need a bit more, some people need a bit less. That's fine. All normal. Why? Because what's the foundational philosophy here? What is driving us? What is driving our mindset at least? What's our aspiration? Giving and selflessness. I'm a normal person. I'm not Reb Zusha. I'm not Reb Chaim Briska. So, okay. So I need to give to myself too. I need to protect, sometimes create a boundary. But it's all in the context of getting to be able to be a giving person. Because that's my philosophy. My behavior is more, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. Because I just need to protect myself. Because otherwise, you know, I'm gonna be a nothing, or I'm gonna burn out, or whatever the case is. But when it becomes a whole philosophy, like it's coming in today's society, where you have to learn how to say no, and you have to learn how to do this, you have to not say no. Truthy, of course. But when that becomes the whole driving principle of the way you live, that's a sodomite. I think that's the way to read the Mishnah. So I think that's a formula for lots of things, and I think it's an interesting way of doing it, right? Okay. The last part of the spire principle is the emotional well-being. And a lot is spoken about today about being in touch with our emotions, and it's true, and it's very in line with Judaism on one level. I always bring this in. Of course, we learn from the laws of grief that it's very important to express emotion and to know you, to acknowledge pain and so on and so forth, right? As I always share with you, that the Talmud talks about two different blessings. One you make for good things, one you make for bad things. And it says you should make them in the same way, with the same determination, the same faith, and even same happiness. But yet at the same time, they're different blessings. They're not the same blessing, right? Because what's bad is bad, what's good is good. We feel it differently. Okay. So he talks about the importance of being in touch with our emotions and acknowledging them and so on and so forth. And he talks about he divides them. I'm going to do it a bit differently than he does it, because which I think is more in line with Jewish thinking. He divides emotions, as many people do, into positive and negative emotions, right? Now, it's a little bit with the philosophy, and I think it's an important perspective to understand from a Jewish point of view. He talks about it with the philosophy that really no emotion is bad. And that's why it's okay to feel them, right? So that's the very, very most recent sort of modern thinking goes like that. No emotion is really bad. That's why don't be upset if you feel anger or you feel resentment or you feel pain or whatever the case is, because no emotion is really bad, and therefore it's okay to feel them. As the famous thing, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to feel like I'm upset today, I'm angry, I'm envious, I'm jealous, I'm resentful. It's all okay. Now, the truth is that's not in line with Jewish thinking. Although it is in line with Jewish thinking to feel your emotions. Let me explain. And I thought this was important, a good opportunity to actually share this. First of all, you need to divide emotions into three, not into two. It's a mistake to divide it into two. You actually need to divide it into three. There are good and positive emotions. There are painful emotions. And then there's toxic emotions. Different. They're very different. Toxic, I mean, like wrong, negative emotions, right? It's a different formula. Interestingly enough, Although Judaism, for the most part, is an action-based religion, right? It's a very, very action-based religion. Most of our mitzvot are completely action-based. No matter what you feel, you do it, you do the mitzvah, right? And most of it is what you can't do in behavior, because that is the emphasis. It's how you live, not what you feel. But it's also a mistake to think that that's the only part of Judaism. Judaism actually very much talks about our emotions. In the positive way, there's a commandment to love God and to fear God. There's a commandment to love other people. Right? There's a prohibition against jealousy. There's a prohibition against not only taking revenge, but bearing a grudge. There's a prohibition in the Torah, Allah tisna, you may not hate someone else. These are prohibitions. Right? In other words, Torah actually does have an opinion and have something to say about the emotions you feel. And Torah says there are certain emotions, certain feelings that are negative or perhaps even prohibited. Now we have to understand what that means, which I'm going to explain. Understand? So that's actually different to modern thinking. You know, Rabbi Twersky already spoke about this a long time ago. For example, anger. So there is a philosophy that anger is okay to feel, just can't punch the other guy in the nose. Because that's not good, right? That's behaviorally bad. And there, as a result of that, there is a philosophy, and there still is a philosophy, that if you're angry, go punch a ball. Right? Punch a bag, whatever. Judaism doesn't hold to that. Doesn't subscribe to that. No, anger is bad for you. And therefore, don't go punch. Deal with your anger. Right? Now, Dennis Prager recently, although I like a lot of what he says politically, but he made this very, very fundamental mistake recently. He's giving a talk on religion, which he should probably stay away from, actually. But... Yeah. To be honest, he's a real good expert on Israel and politics and stuff like that. But religion is anyway. You should leave it to us. You should leave it to other people. But maybe because he's talking about the oral Torah and the written Torah. He's this. He only believes in the written Torah, and he's he has his own Talmud. But anyway, so he has this thing that the difference between Judaism and Christianity. He says that Judaism is only a religion of action, right? And if we say sinful thoughts are not a problem in Judaism. Right? He has this philosophy that if like someone commits adultery in the mind, it's okay. It's not okay. That is not true. Right? It's explicitly in the Torah that it's not true. You just need to understand how it's translated, how it's interpreted. It says, Lo tapturi, may not follow your hearts and your eyes. One has to be careful with these things because it is not true. Right? Even in your mind, it's bad. It's not as bad as you do in action, but it is. Okay. So how do you do with this? So how does that fit into what he's saying? So the way it works is as follows. This is discussed actually quite at length in the book of Tanya, written, you know, the foundational book of Chabad Hasidism, written by the first Chabad Rebbe. Explained in many places, but he focused on this quite a bit. He talks about the average person, right? The average Jew, meaning the exception of great tzaddikim. So let's leave the tzaddikim out of this for a moment, right? There are great tzaddikim who are at such levels where they are complete control of themselves, they'll never even have the initial thought of negative emotions. Okay, fine. Most of us are not like that. Most of us have feelings of anger, resentment, jealousy, anything else that comes with it, right? Then there's painful emotions, like grief. Grief is not a negative emotion, it's a painful emotion. There's a difference, understand? So there are toxic emotions, there are negative emotions, and there's painful emotions. So even with pain, even with toxic emotions or negative emotions, most people are not at the level where they don't have initial thoughts or initial feelings that are negative, right? So we all have them. So then how can God prohibit them if it's impossible for people never to have feelings of, right? See, behavior is much easier to mandate, right? God could say, you must light Shabbos candles every Friday night. Okay? So that's our choice. We can do it or not do it. But everyone, it's possible for everyone to do it. You make a choice to do it. You're not in the mood, you're on the mood, you're upset with Hashem, you're not upset. But you can do it. You can light the candle, right? Emotions are very, very hard to mandate. Love Hashem. Maybe I don't love Him. It's like saying, you know, like I've told this before, it's like saying to an American, you have to love Vegemite. But it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't work, right? It's a taste thing. So you can say you have to eat it. Yeah, you force yourself, but, right? So the way it's explained is like this. That, and that's where I think the modern literature is wrong. The reason why it's okay to have a feeling is not because it's right. It's because you're normal. So God says, if you have an initial feeling, if someone says something really bad to you, offends you, and you feel that emotion of anger swelling up, or you see someone that you have a disposition to jealousy, and you see someone have something really, really nice, and suddenly you have a feeling of jealousy, two things have to come to mind from a Jewish perspective, ideally. What has to come to mind is, I'm not a bad person for having that emotion, but the emotion is still wrong and I've got to work on it. And it might take weeks to work on it. It might take months, years, doesn't matter. You understand? In other words, just because it's okay to have something doesn't make it good. I think that's what the modern world struggles with. Because essentially I am good. It's not my depth of my soul that's jealous. It's my outer garments, as I've always shared this with you, right? It's my consciousness. It's my conscious feelings. And that's what God did. He gave me weaknesses. He gave it for most people, except for the very, very few pious people. But, right, He made us normal. He made us with strengths and weaknesses. He made us with rough patches of personality. And therefore, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to have those feelings. But it's not okay to accept those feelings. Very different. I woke up in the morning. I was really upset. Someone said something to me. I'm feeling really angry. It doesn't make me a bad person. Don't be upset about it. Don't feel guilty. Don't beat yourself up because you're normal. You're perfectly normal and intrinsically you are still perfectly good. But don't accept those emotions. That's where they're going wrong today. Understand? Now, the truth is, he says it himself a little bit later. He says that, because the main point is that you have to acknowledge your emotions, which I agree with, which is true. Right? But he says you mustn't accept them long term. I mean, this is the whole time of the year we're in now, right? Sfirat HaOmer, the time of the Omer. 7 weeks. Why we have 7 weeks corresponding to the seven emotions of the human being, chesed, wur, and so on. This is particularly a time during the year to work on our emotions and to remove those toxic emotions, right? So how does it yes work? So it works like this. It is true, let's just summarize this. It is true that you have to acknowledge an emotion. It is true with painful emotions that actually even have to be expressed, not just acknowledged, but they have to be expressed, right? With negative emotions, it is also true they have to be acknowledged. I wouldn't say they have to be expressed, but they have to be processed, right? Now, the reason for this is very simple. Because if you don't acknowledge your emotions, then you don't even understand them. You can't even deal with them. You can't work with them if you don't know it, right? That's why we have this concept in Judaism, not every single day, not 24 hours a day, but we have this idea of cheshbon ha-nefesh, normally before Rosh Hashanah particularly, where we reflect and we acknowledge the good and the bad. We acknowledge what's going on. But even on a daily basis, if I get upset, or if I get angry, if I'm jealous, or if I'm hateful, or if I'm resentful, it's important to acknowledge that it's there, not to beat myself up. It's important to acknowledge that it's not that it's toxic, and I'm going to and to commit to working on it. But you need to know what it is first in order to work on it. Right? I'm saying that because there's a lot of now emotional training going on in educational systems, which I think is being a bit overdone. That's a separate story. But it's very much comes with a line often, and I've seen it even you know. I seem to think that one of the things I teach kids, there's no such thing as a bad emotion. That's not true. There is. There's no such thing as a bad person, maybe. Right? In other words, there's no such thing as being bad because you had a bad emotion. That's the point we have to understand. So, for the most part, it's true. In other words, it is the important part. We have to be in touch with ourselves. We have to be emotionally healthy. We also have to understand what is good, what is painful, and what is negative, and to respond in kind to work with it. The point, obviously, with this chapter is that all of this brings emotional well-being. Now again, it's the same thing I said before. You know, as I said, like now in schools, they're doing a lot of emotional training. Secular schools, Jewish schools. I wrote an article recently about this in a website that's mainly seen by in New York, and I made a few waves. Not everyone was happy with me, but it's okay. I think I was fairly balanced, it was good. But because I think it's also, it runs a danger. Yes, so we do have to be in touch with our emotions. We have to be in touch with our feelings and know how to process them and respond to them. But we mustn't get too absorbed in it either. Right? I think some people are now becoming like, it's becoming extreme. It always happens, the pendulum, right? Mm-hmm. Where now it's all about like, are you in touch with yourself and yourself and your own thing and accepting your feelings. And so one of the things I said, I mean, again, you do have to be in touch. It's true. It's like that same thing we said before. It needs to be done. It just shouldn't become the whole philosophy of life to be in touch with your own emotions, right? One of the things I did suggest in that article, which I think is true, especially in schools, that if you want to teach about emotions and teach about being in touch with the emotions and understand and processing them, really the focus should be is about teaching about other people's emotions. Teach kids what it feels, teach people empathy. Teach them about what it feels like when someone else is bullied, when someone else is left out, when someone else is isolated, right? But then they'll see how it feels with themselves also. Maybe they'll learn it through that medium. It'll be much more helpful and effective not to cultivate selfishness, right? But nevertheless, it is true that one needs to be in touch with one's own emotions, one needs to acknowledge them, but then respond the way we're supposed to respond. Respond knowing it's okay to have any emotion, where none of us are that pious, we all have emotions, but with negative emotions, to understand and accept that they're negative, and therefore to commit to processing them and working them, and trying not to express them, but rather reframing them and working it through. All that emotional health, of course, is that fifth component that contributes to overall wellness and overall happiness. So that's the Spire model. Again, a reminder, next week we don't have a session, and then we start again a new series in 2 weeks' time. Yes.